This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. You're listening to the News Roundup. Health experts say it's finally happened. We've reached the point where vaccine supply is starting to exceed demand. 45% of American adults have received one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, but the pace of vaccinations has dropped from 4 million a day at its peak last month to roughly 2 million a day now. The number of new COVID-19 cases has also fallen nearly 30% in the last 2 weeks. But if vaccinations continue to stall, can Americans keep another wave at bay? Let's get into that and the week's top political news with Anita Kumar. She's a White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico. Anita, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Jen.
Also with us, Ed O'Keefe, a political correspondent with CBS News. Ed, it's always great to have you on.
Great to be back.
And Maggie Fox, a senior health editor with CNN. Maggie, great to have you with us.
Always nice to be with you.
So President Biden has a new benchmark and a new vaccination strategy.
Our goal by July 4th is to have 70% of adult Americans with at least one shot and 160 million Americans fully vaccinated.
Maggie, why 70%?
Well, it's actually a pretty modest goal, but it's a good goal. It kind of sends the message that you're more than halfway there. We've done some calculations, and it will be very easy for the U.S. to achieve that goal, even with a continuing drop-off in the number of people getting vaccinated. So the Biden administration has continued with its sort of goals of, you know, under-promise and over-deliver.
But is that a riskier strategy with the 70%? If the current vaccination trend continues, he might not be able to hit that goal.
Well, again, we've done the calculations, and it would have to drop off a considerable amount more for him to fall short of that goal. And remember, we'll be having new groups coming on. We're expecting the Food and Drug Administration to approve the use of Pfizer's vaccine in 12 to 15-year-olds, and that'll up the number of people who are eligible to be vaccinated, and there'll be a bump there because there's certainly maybe about 30% of parents who are really eager to get those kids that age vaccinated. Moderna is also applying for that license sometime soon, that extension of the EUA, the emergency use authorization. And the U.S. is also changing its strategy about how people can get vaccinated. The mass vaccination sites are closing, and now more vaccines are being made available in easier to reach places like the retail pharmacies, like doctor's offices. There are places where people like the firefighters are going around into neighborhoods and trying to help get people vaccinated where they are, because it's not just vaccine skeptics who aren't being vaccinated. There are also people who find it hard to find the time or don't have a car to go to a mass vaccination site who need to be reached where they are.
Anita, Biden has spent a lot of his first 100 days setting these various COVID benchmarks for the U.S. to head. Talk about some of the political strategy at work here.
Yeah, I mean, he campaigned on getting the coronavirus under control. So he really had to make these first 100 days, which we just passed, the primary goal. Now, you're starting to see him talk about other issues, his spending plans that are out there, infrastructure. But this will still continue to be, you know, the thing that he looks back on the first year as, you know, the most important thing. You know, he campaigned on President Trump, you know, his opponent saying President Trump mishandled this and didn't take it seriously enough. So this has brought so many different aspects together for him. He is trying to convey that this administration supports science, and he was saying the Trump administration didn't, that they were you know, they didn't take it seriously, that they weren't organized, that they couldn't get all this done. So this has been a major issue for him. And you've seen a lot of, you know, we've had lots of things that the president has been criticized. They all are, right? But this hasn't been one of them as much as some other the other issues. So this is something that they wanted to do and that they feel that they've done a good job, in part because of what Maggie said, the expectations. He said he set modest goals and succeeded in surpassing them.
Now, Maggie, some health experts are now saying that the U.S. may never achieve actual herd immunity. Remind us, what is herd immunity?
Well, herd immunity is kind of a vague idea, but it's the idea that enough people in the population have either been infected or vaccinated or are immune in some way, that the virus has nowhere to go. And so it just stops circulating. It's not the same thing as eradicating a virus or an infection, but it means there isn't a population spreading it. The estimate for what it would take to get herd immunity in the U.S. would be about 75 to 80% of people vaccinated. And that's a pretty hard goal to reach with any kind of vaccination, especially one that starts in adults. It's easier to kind of get kids vaccinated when they're really little. So a lot of experts say it's unlikely to happen soon enough to stop this virus before it mutates a little bit like flu does. It doesn't mutate as fast as flu does, but it will be a moving target for the vaccines. And many, many people are now saying this could be an annual shot that we have to get every year, perhaps along with the flu shot.
And so what does it mean for us if we don't hit that marker?
Well, it means that coronavirus will be here to stay, and it could mean a winter bump because we now know that this virus is transmitted indoors when people are sharing the same air. So as cooler months come and people move inside and school starts back up and people start doing more indoor events, everyone who knows about viral transmission says, yep, we're absolutely going to see another bump in the number of cases.
We got this email from Ron who says the issue with getting to vaccine doubters is not totally up to President Biden. He can only ask people a limited number of times, and the lockstep Trumpers won't even listen if he speaks. A lot of doubters are bombarded with lies and nonsense constantly by bad websites. The truth is drowned by the nonsense, and the ignorance is a virus. Ed, Biden is pushing this new vaccination strategy, but how much control does he really have here?
Oh, not much at all. And I think, you know, it's to your listener's point, the White House has conceded since the beginning of the year. In fact, I remember asking the president at one point, you know, would you encourage former President Trump to speak out? And he said, look, it's not me, it's not him who should be doing this. It's local doctors, it's local public health officials, it's your pastor, it's, you know, somebody you work with, your neighbor, who is the most effective advocate for us in this regard. It's not me, it's not Dr. Fauci, it's not other national leaders. And so, you know, the White House can only urge those local influence makers or influencers to speak out and, you know, behave or encourage people to do things in a certain way. And so, you know, he's using his bully pulpit, as he is totally equipped to do. And I think their attitude is, if he doesn't appear to be out there encouraging people to do it, then it's perhaps, you know, not taking full advantage of presidential leadership and the presidential megaphone. And at the same time, you know, hoping and encouraging other people at a lower level of government and society to speak out as well.
Ed, I don't know where you're joining us from, but the bird song is providing the very best musical background for our conversation today. You know, Maggie, even as vaccinations stagnate, more and more states are loosening restrictions. Florida lifted all its COVID-19 restrictions this week. Minnesota plans to lift all restrictions by the end of the month. And Virginia says it will fully reopen by June 15th. What do scientists think about this rush to reopen?
Well, most scientists say this is not a great idea because the minute you lift restrictions, people get the idea that it's a free-for-all and that they can do anything. The CDC is trying to provide guidelines about how to go ahead and move around safely with no restrictions, but it's clear that people do not understand the message. And the fear is that people will start just acting as if the virus is gone, and they'll start gathering inside, they'll start going to bars, they'll start having family reunions where some people aren't vaccinated. And until enough of the population is vaccinated to lower the risk of viral transmission, these kinds of behaviors are going to continue the spread of the virus. And so the advice is to governors and people at the top to send the message: we can see safety ahead of us. It's not quite there. And really, we just need to hang in there a little bit more.
Well, we got this tweet from Sabina who says, what are the guidelines with planes and physical distancing? I have learned that Copa Airlines, sometimes the most direct or only option to fly from Latin America, is not requiring a seat in between passengers, and planes are packed. How can this be allowed? Maggie, we're at a point where people are starting to think about potential travel this summer. What do we know about how the airlines are handling this?
Well, they're not just thinking about travel, they're doing it. Past weekends have hit record numbers, and now all of the airlines have dropped that empty middle seat idea. It's partly because some studies have shown that airplanes are kind of a unique place for people to be. They have rapid air circulation and air ventilation. They really pull that air out fast, and there's a much lower risk of transmission on an airplane if, and this is a big if everybody's wearing a mask, because no air circulation can protect you from somebody who's right next to you or right behind you and breathing germs out. Travel is risky because there are choke points where people come together, right? In airports, in the airport transportation, when you're going to and from, on a train, you don't have the air circulation. And so as people travel more, there's probably going to be more travel-related spread. And remember, the U.S. is probably vaccinating more people than anyone. So as people go to other countries, they're going to be exposed to the virus more than they would be at home.
Well, Dr. Cross joins the conversation on Twitter, saying for those who refuse to be vaxxed, limitations and precautions need to be in place to protect the public health. No vax, no work, no vax, no access, no vax, no normalcy for those who choose to disregard the health of others. We'll continue discussing the week's biggest headlines in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Amazon Prime Video with the Underground Railroad. From Academy Award winner Barry Jenkins and based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Colson Whitehead, the new Amazon original The Underground Railroad chronicles Cora Randall, played by newcomer Tuso Mbedu. When she discovers an actual network of trains and tunnels beneath the southern soil, Cora must evade a violent bounty hunter before she can find freedom. The Underground Railroad premieres May 14th on Amazon Prime Video.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Wyzant, a one-to-one tutoring alternative to online classes where you can learn face-to-face online. Get help with tackling new subjects and career skills, or just catching up. Wyzant lists thousands of personal instructors in over 300 subjects, available for live, individualized lessons with their online learning platform. Head to wyzant.com to find your perfect instructor. Love it or your first hour is free. Because at Wyzant, we take learning personally.
Today, it seems like everybody's got a bone to pick with the news. So what happens when somebody stops talking smack and just decides to wage all-out war?
First thing you do in an invasion, you eliminate the communications of the enemy.
And what happens if they win? Visit Stockton, California, for a story about a revolt against the mainstream media that's shaken up a city. From NPR's Invisibilia.
You're listening to the News Roundup. Let's jump back into the conversation with this email from Patricia, who says, once the official announcement about the vaccine being available for 12 to 15-year-olds comes out, will these vaccines be available at any of the sites or only a select few? Will the mass vaccination sites be available? And Maggie, as you mentioned, the FDA is expected to authorize Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for use in some teenagers early next week. What more do we know about how it will be distributed?
Well, there are actually places that are getting ready to vaccinate kids these age now. Pediatricians' offices are hoping that they can expect delivery of vaccine. And some of the big medical centers, of course, have pediatrics departments, and they'll be ready to deliver the vaccines to kids these age. And, of course, children can also go to the retail pharmacies that have been designated vaccination centers. That's part of the goal of getting the vaccinations out of these big mass vac sites and more into places where people can just walk in or make an appointment with their own familiar pediatrician or physician to get the vaccine.
And so how soon after authorization could teens start getting these shots?
Almost immediately, the FDA is telling us, and the CDC has already scheduled an emergency meeting of their advisors, because this has to go through some of the same steps as full authorization. Once FDA signs off on this emergency use authorization extension, then the CDC's advisory committee will meet. They've scheduled an emergency meeting for Wednesday, and they can move that if they need to, so that they can recommend that the vaccine be used in this age group. Then the CDC signs off on it, and within hours, shots could be going into teenagers' arms.
And what about for younger children? I know a lot of parents have questions about where that process is.
Well, the vaccine makers are testing their vaccines in this younger age group. That's probably going to be subject to a little bit more scrutiny just because it is a more sensitive issue. There's no reason to think that the vaccines wouldn't be safe in younger children, but these trials are a little different. They're testing different doses to see if a lower dose might work better in children or might be enough for these younger children. Then the FDA will go ahead and do a review. That will probably be subject to more advisor input. input than this decision on the teenagers. And maybe by the fall or at the end of the next year, those younger kids could be eligible for the vaccine too.
Now, Ed, this week, Biden backed the idea of suspending patents on COVID-19 vaccines, and this was considered a bit of a surprise move. Why?
Because there was a thought that the Biden administration actually wouldn't go along with this. The pharmaceutical industry, the business community, Republicans, others concerned that by doing this, you know, you're cutting into the profits of these companies and you're sort of violating the principle of intellectual property rights and the idea that, you know, if a company or if a person develops something, they should be allowed to, you know, continue to own and profit from that idea. But the flip side argument, and the one that the administration appears to be signing on to, is, look, the world is in desperate need of this. While the United States is doing a pretty decent job of getting people vaccinated, it's far ahead of many other countries in the world, and especially the developing world, where virtually nobody's been vaccinated so far. And so by going to the World Trade Organization after several other countries said they were interested in doing this and essentially agreeing now that the WTO should move to lift these intellectual property rights, the United States signaling that they're eager to do this. The question is, how quickly could it be done? And will other manufacturers have the raw materials needed to make these vaccines safely and accurately in order to get around the world? But, you know, part of this, too, is a sort of global diplomacy concern that you have China and before its big disaster with COVID in the recent days, India and Russia, who've been doling out and sending vaccine supply around the world, especially to Latin America and Africa. The United States, if it wants to continue to be seen as a reliable ally, has to consider doing the same. And this is one step to help make that happen.
Maggie, before we let you go, this morning, Pfizer and BioNTech applied to the FDA for full approval of their COVID vaccine. How much does full approval matter here in helping with vaccine confidence?
Well, there's a lot of people who think that once the vaccine's fully approved, this extra step of scrutiny will give people the confidence to go ahead and get it. It's not clear how much more scrutiny is actually involved in full approval. When the FDA decided to just do emergency use authorization for these vaccines, they made it very clear that this was going to be just barely short of what's required for full approval, that they would require full clinical trials, lots of data, lots of information on the manufacturing side. So it will only be a little bit of a bump in terms of scrutiny and new data on the safety and efficacy of these vaccines. Nonetheless, there's lots of people who see those words emergency use and think that means the vaccine hasn't been checked out as much. And perhaps those people will get over the bump. I'd like to weigh in a little bit, too, on what you were talking about with Ed on this patent extension. There's another big argument against it. And that is that the patents alone aren't enough to help other countries manufacture these very complex vaccines. You actually need a pretty close cooperation between the owner of the patent, the people who invented and who are making the vaccine, and those who want to license it for kind of generic manufacturing. This isn't like the HIV drugs that are so cheap and so easy to make that they can be made on site in developing nations. These are much more complex products. There's also the argument that vaccine makers will just get out of the business if they worry that their inventions will be shared freely with the world and they won't be able to profit from years and years of research.
That's Maggie Fox. She's a senior health editor with CNN. Maggie, always great to have you on.
Always a pleasure.
Now, this week, Facebook's oversight board upheld the company's decision to restrict Donald Trump's access to posting on his Facebook page and Instagram account. But they called the indefinite ban inappropriate and told Facebook it needs to come up with a better solution in the next 6 months. Board Chair Hella Thorning-Schmidt spoke to reporters after the announcement.
The decision made by the oversight board today illustrate, in my view, exactly why independent oversight matters. Anyone who is concerned about Facebook's excessive concentration of power should welcome the oversight board clearly telling Facebook that they cannot invent new unwritten rules when it suits them. The board's purpose is to shift Facebook from an arbitrary approach to content moderation to one where Facebook's rules are clear, transparent, and treat all users fairly.
Anita, just quickly remind us why former President Trump got kicked off Facebook in the first place.
Yeah, President Trump got removed from Facebook and Twitter and other places, other social media, really after the January 6th you know, riots at the Capitol. There had been concerns actually for quite some time with some of his social media talking about how the election was not fair and there was fraud. And then after January 6th, there was more criticism about that he was basically inciting violence. And so it's not just Facebook, but we've seen this come up with Facebook. There was a lot of people, waiting to see what this oversight board would do and whether he would get back on. But there had been criticisms, as you know, for years, really, on some of the things that he said that they just were not true.
What does the outcome of this case suggest about Facebook's stance on platform oversight, especially when it comes to elected leaders?
Well, it's been really, you know, these social media groups have been, or outlets have been in sort of a trying to have a balancing act. They resisted really oversight in a lot of ways for a long time and felt really forced to do so when there were calls from people all over saying, look, they're spreading misinformation. And so you've seen things like this oversight board, which is basically a panel of journalists and activists and lawyers, which is acting sort of as a quasi-court over the company, you know, coming up with ways to look at these issues. And, you know, the board did come out and say, look, Facebook didn't respond appropriately. They did and they didn't. They have more work to do. So what we're seeing now is people on one side saying, look, they shouldn't be doing this. This is a First Amendment issue. And people on another side saying this doesn't go far enough, that they need to restrict more, they need to police more, that there's just too much disinformation out there. And this is putting them sort of all of them in this process sort of in the middle, trying to figure out what to do.
Well, you have some thoughts about this. Chris writes on Facebook, this decision suggests that Mark Zuckerberg is frightened to assess on his own, without an oversight board, violations of the terms of service of his own private company. By comparison, Jack Dorsey of Twitter looks like an owner who doesn't spend his time hand-wringing to defend his platform's terms. And Matthew writes, at best, establishing an oversight committee seems like a reactive, bare minimum effort that Facebook was finally pushed into. Facebook's problems go much deeper. Deeper than Donald Trump. Now, Trump may be off Facebook and Instagram, but that hasn't stopped him from maintaining an online presence. This week, he launched a new communications website called From the Desk of Donald J. Trump. Now, Ed, Fox News first reported on the site calling it a new communications platform, but it appears to be more like a blog. What can you tell us?
Yeah, that's basically all it is. It's a blog, and then you've got the opportunity, if you so choose, to tweet out the link or to post it on Facebook. But there's no way for his supporters to interact with him as they would have on those social media platforms. There's no way for him to himself post those items on his Twitter and Facebook account. Look, you know, one of the things that I know Anita and I have come to adjust to, if you will, in the post-Trump presidency era is that now about once or twice a day, reporters are getting an email from the office of the former president with a statement that is written with the sort of punch and punctuation of a lot of his tweets. You know, spoken just sort of like the way he speaks and lots of exclamation points, a lot of all caps. And it's about Liz Cheney or it's about, you know, something to do with Matt Gaetz or Fox News or The New York Times. He's trying to keep himself in the conversation, but having to use far more conventional or maybe, let's say, 2010s era communication tools like press releases and a blog in order to get the word out when he is, at least for now, blocked from using Facebook and Twitter.
Well, there have also been several attempts to create dummy Twitter accounts in order to tweet quotes from this website that was launched. Just remind us what the situation is with Trump's Twitter ban and how Twitter is handling these dummy accounts, Ed.
As I recall, they're trying to essentially, you know, at least keep an eye on them. And as long as he himself isn't the one operating them, there's very little they can really do in terms of a general violation of their terms. I mean, look, the former president is eager to remain in the conversation, inject himself into it. I think one of the more interesting developments this week was he's trying to now co-opt the term big lie or the big lie that his opponents and the current president have used to describe his feelings about what happened last November by, you know, suggesting that he is, you know, pushing this big lie. Now he's trying to turn around and say, no, the big lie is that liberals and the media and Democrats are telling you that there weren't problems. He's trying to turn it on its head. He did that when he was president. He's continuing to do it now. it's obviously got a less effective, you know, reach now that he's off of those accounts. But it just shows you that he remains quite desperate to be engaged in the conversation and is keeping very close tabs on it from Mar-a-Lago, despite no longer being president.
Well, that leads us very neatly to a rift between two House Republicans, Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California. On Tuesday, McCarthy was caught on a hot mic before a Fox News interview talking about his loss of faith in Cheney.
I think she's got real problems. I've had it with her. It's, you know, I've lost confidence.
McCarthy publicly shared during the interview that his caucus is not happy with Cheney. Anita, let's take a couple of steps back. What's behind this feud?
Yeah, this has been going on a lot longer than just this week. If you'll recall, Cheney was one of the 10 House Republicans who voted in January to impeach then-President Trump for inciting the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. So this was the second impeachment. And she has since then been pretty vocal about what President Trump did, and that she is standing by her vote and her views on this. And this has been long simmering between the two of them, but it really has come to a head in the last, you know, couple weeks. It's interesting, though, that Kevin McCarthy is not saying this is the reason for, you know, her possibly losing her job. It's saying he's saying that she hasn't done enough for the party and the caucus, that she hasn't helped the party unify. Remember, she's the third ranking House Republican, and so obviously works closely with him.
And we should mention Trump has already backed Representative Elise Stefanik of New York to replace Cheney in that leadership role. The feud between Cheney and McCarthy, though, is really a microcosm of the debate over the future of the GOP and where Trump's legacy fits in. Break down this existential moment for the Republican Party.
Oh, I think this really is the, you know, there have been so many of these kinds of weeks, but this is a very critical moment now, especially in the post-Trump era. And we may one day have to call this the post-Trump one era. You never know. But the fact that you have this rift, which essentially is just this, you know, what amounts to a student council election in Congress of who's in charge of bringing the bagels and setting the tables for the weekly meeting. And, oh, yes, you know, setting the message for the general conference. But this is a group of freelancers anyway that pretty much does their own thing. And then it's not like they're pushing any real policy these days beyond general opposition to the president's plans. But, you know, McCarthy has a singular goal of taking the House majority and becoming the next Speaker of the House. And he will do whatever it takes to make that happen for his party and for himself. And if she is seen as, you know, a roadblock to that, he wants that roadblock removed. His colleagues, though, make an important point. This position, in addition to being mostly responsible for some housekeeping things, is supposed to help set the general message of the House Republican Conference. And if a majority of them believe what the former president believes, even if that's wrong or misguided or unfounded, then, you know, you're potentially handing out two song sheets when you need to be handing out one. And so if what they're looking for is somebody else to help craft that message and establish a, if not unified message, then one at least that a majority of them agree with, then yes, she's got to get out of the way. And, you know, she will go down, it appears, swinging, making her point that if you want to do this, you're essentially codifying and once again going on the record approving of what happened on January 6th. Mm-hmm. And she believes that's dangerous for the future of the GOP.
Anita, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. This is going to continue to go on, this rift in the party. Of course, the parties are always divided. But this is something that's just going to continue out there as President Trump continues to have that influence over at least half the party.
We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Womply. Womply is committed to helping self-employed workers and small businesses get their PPP loan. They've helped over 100,000 small businesses. Even if you're a freelancer or gig worker, you may qualify. Womply makes the process easy. Start your application at womply.com/NPR, and they'll route it to an approved lender. Apply for free today at WOMPLY.com/NPR and see if you qualify.
Hi, it's Jen White. From politics to pop culture, 1A is the place for the national conversation on NPR. And our upgraded 1A Vox Pop app is the fastest and easiest way to add your voice. You'll see the latest and get a jump on upcoming stories all at the press of a button. Download the new 1A Vox Pop app for iOS and Android today and make yourself heard loud and clear on 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
You're listening to the News Roundup. We're discussing the week's biggest headlines. Let's stick with politics for a moment. This week, a federal judge called for the release of a secret memo that then-Attorney General Barr cited to clear President Trump from obstruction of justice. Anita, why is this memo important?
Well, let's just go back. This is something that a watchdog group 2 years ago had tried to get through a public records request, and it has been winding its way through the court system. This is important because this group, and it's the group is Citizens for Ethics and Responsibility in Washington, otherwise known as CREW, basically saw some of the comments that the then Attorney General Bill Barr made, basically saying that, acting as if, look, the president, then president, President Trump, couldn't be charged with anything that was related to this Mueller report and the Russia investigation. And it seemed as if it was just a done deal, right? That there wasn't a full investigation by the Department of Justice. What this group wanted was the justification for those comments and why the president couldn't be charged. So it wasn't public. It was prepared by the Office of the Legal Counsel, which is a section of the Justice Department that provides the federal government with legal interpretations, but those are often secret, so we don't get to see them. Sometimes we do, but we don't often do. So they wanted to see what was the justification for not pursuing anything against President Trump in this Mueller probe.
Now, at the time, the Department of Justice argued the memo should not be released to the public because it was legal reasoning that helped Barr decide whether to prosecute Trump during the Mueller investigation, as Anita said. But Ed, connect the dots for us, because wouldn't the fact that it helped Barr decide this monumental thing, wouldn't that be the reason it should be made public?
You would think, yes, certainly. I mean, I think what's most fascinating about this is it's just simply a reminder to everybody that, you know, while the Trump presidency is over, the ongoing investigations into him, into his associates, into what was going on at a Justice Department that was clearly controlled by his allies is going to continue and has to continue in the eyes of many, because if it doesn't, then, you know, there are real questions about the rule of law and the reputation of the Justice Department and the judicial system. So, you know, there are people out there clearly who probably are exhausted by this, who might roll their eyes or change the channel when the conversation comes up. But the reality is, these are investigations that could continue now for several more years. And we're going to continue to hear through court cases and other, you know, writings and reporting about what was going on to protect and potentially shield the president from potential legal harm, and then just the public in general from knowing what was going on.
Well, let's check in on the current AG. Attorney General Merrick Garland is asking Congress for more funding to fight domestic terrorism.
We never want to take our eyes off of what happened on 9/11 and of the risks that the country continues to face from foreign origin terrorist attacks on the homeland. Likewise, we have a growing fear of domestic violent extremism and domestic terrorism. And both of those keep me up at night.
Ed, this was the Attorney General's first public testimony. What more did we learn about his priorities?
Well, this certainly remains a big one. And he was asked about the ongoing investigations into the January 6th attacks and, you know, just a general sense of how he's reshaping the Justice Department. It's incredible that, and I think it's part of the reason why, it's certainly a big reason why the president chose him to run the department, that domestic terrorism now or potential for domestic extremism is such a concern. This is somebody who had prosecuted Timothy McVeigh, was involved in the Unabomber case back in the 1990s, somebody who has a real good, keen understanding of the threat as it was then and as it remains now. And just this morning, for example, the Justice Department announcing that they're bringing civil rights violation concerns against those four officers involved in the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, an example of a Justice Department that's getting much more aggressive on concerns about law enforcement in this country as well, and a good example of how many would believe the Justice Department is getting back to the kinds of cases and the focus it needs to have.
Well, let's turn to immigration for a moment. This week, Biden announced he will raise the number of refugees allowed into the country to as many as 62,500 people through September. And it's an about-face for the president, who initially wanted to keep his predecessor's historically low refugee cap. Anita, why the reversal here?
Because of just the scathing criticism against him and the administration. So let's remember that President Biden has been saying for quite some time that he was going to reverse all of President Trump's actions on immigration, which obviously we remember was a key thing for President Trump. You know, that was something he worked on to restrict immigration, legal and illegal immigration, for 4 years. So President Biden came in and said he would do the opposite. He would reverse that. It's been very tough for him, not just with this refugee cap, but all over. It's been very tough. He's learning that it's very hard to do that overnight. It's a long process in some cases, and that there are consequences for trying to do that. So he had announced that he would allow more refugees in, but then when he came into office, basically he said, look, we have growing number of migrants trying to come over the border. We've all heard about these unaccompanied minors that are coming over the border, and we just can't handle it right now. So we're going to limit the number. We're going to keep it the same as President Trump did. And there was just an enormous blowback from Democrats on Capitol Hill, activists who thought he broke a promise. It was very quick and very harsh. And so what we saw was that he went back to what he said. What's really important to note here is that even though he says that number is going to be 62,500, that's admissions are still likely to fall short of that mark. Mm-hmm. This is what's allowed, but it doesn't necessarily mean this is the number that will come in before September.
And why not? What are the limitations there?
Yeah, and so it still has to go through the process. Even though these people are allowed, they still need to go through the process of processing and getting them here. And it oftentimes it just doesn't happen that those numbers are reached. Of course, what President Trump said was, we're not even going to allow those numbers to be reached. We're going to limit it to 15,000. So, there are activists now that really were very critical a few weeks ago, saying, look, this is the right way to go, but we need to do more. And of course, President Biden reinforced again this week that his goal would be 125,000 for the next fiscal year, which of course starts in October. So he again said, hey, look, that number is still going to be hard to hit next year.
Well, let's turn to voting rights. More than 180 local businesses and 50 corporations have come together to fight voting restrictions in Texas. And they're targeting two pieces of legislation that would reallocate polling machines and restrict options for early voting. Ed, bring us up to speed on what's happening in Texas. What is this legislation?
Well, early Friday morning, it passed the Texas House, and it's expected to head to final passage as early as next week if the Texas Senate doesn't make any more big changes. But essentially, it does what similar legislation did in Florida, in Georgia, in Iowa, and it's up for consideration in places like Ohio. It would restrict the use of ballot drop boxes. It penalizes those that might try to commit irregularities. It makes it easier for partisan poll watchers to stand in a polling site and potentially even photograph you while you're taking your while you're casting your ballot. The negotiation over it stretched into the night, in part because Democrats had threatened to introduce hundreds of amendments to the legislation that would have dragged this out probably through the weekend. They cut a deal with Republicans to water it down a bit. And again, it's been going back and forth between the House and the Senate, and it's expected now that we will see it pass and get sent to Governor Abbott, the Republican governor who's set to sign it. But, these bills continue to be passed by Republican-led legislators, encouraged by Republican governors who are all responding to incredible pressure from rank-and-file base Republican voters. In a recent CBS News poll, 70% of Republicans in this country said Joe Biden is not the legitimately elected president, which is a signal that they continue to believe last fall's elections did not go as they were supposed to, despite evidence to the contrary. And in case after case and state after state, Republican governors, many of whom are up for re-election next year, know that they have to appear to be doing something to address these concerns if they, A, want to win a primary, and B, get re-elected in these overwhelmingly Republican states.
Anita, how are Democrats pushing back against both these legislative moves, but also this narrative, this false narrative, that the election was rigged in some way?
Yeah, well, as Ed indicated in that poll, I mean, it's been very difficult for them. They are talking about this, pushing back, campaigning on it, but it doesn't seem to be budging. It doesn't seem to be convincing Republicans who believe that the election was rigged and that former President Donald Trump really did win. But I think, you know, we're going to continue to see this issue as a campaign issue in the midterm elections next year. It'll be 2 years after and people are still talking about the election and campaigning on the issue. What's been interesting to me, though, is that while you're seeing, as Ed mentioned, all these different Republican legislatures push these laws, you've seen Democrats try to push back on them. You've seen Democrats in Congress trying to pass a voting rights bill that is currently not going anywhere. It's gone through the House and still hasn't gone through the Senate, and unclear sort of what's going to happen to that. And you're going to see businesses and other community leaders talking about this. That's the thing you brought up originally. Businesses have slowly over these last few years started to get more involved. So if you'll remember when Georgia passed something similar, you saw Delta and Coke, which are both based there in Georgia, coming out. You saw Major League Baseball moving its All-Star game. So you're starting to see other people, businesses, community groups get involved in a way we perhaps didn't see before.
I'm curious, Ed, to your mind, how this connects with the work of Attorney General Merrick Garland, because you have this narrative again out there that, among some, false narrative, that the election was stolen. We know that was part of what led to the January 6th insurrection. How much more important does the work of the AG's office come into play in helping to shift the narrative?
Well, it's not just the AG's office, it's the Justice Department overall, and whether, you know, career prosecutors in these states take up the issue or raise their concerns about potential civil rights violations or violations of other federal election law. For example, there's this ongoing recount of ballots in Maricopa County, Arizona, mm-hmm. the most populous county that encompasses Phoenix, bankrolled by the local Republicans and being conducted by a private entity. And they're looking at ballots in ways that critics say could be tampered with to try to at least slightly change the results. Well, the Justice Department this week sort of weighed in and told Arizona Republicans, look, you may be in violation of various federal laws. Keep that in mind, and we're going to keep tabs on this. You've seen several lawsuits filed already in Florida, which signed and put into law its new voting law this week, and it's likely that those will work their way through the federal court system. And we'll see if at some point the Justice Department feels obligated to intervene in one or several of these cases or several of these states, which are passing in general relatively similar legislation, all on the idea of going after drop boxes, the absentee ballot application process, the early voting process. You know, states and localities are supposed to set the rules, but there are some expectations in federal law about what's generally supposed to happen. And there are going to be some really compelling legal arguments in the coming months that some believe, at least, that rights are being infringed upon by passing this legislation, which, again, there is very little evidence to suggest was necessary.
Anita, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, definitely this is, going to continue to be an issue that we're going to hear about. It's very difficult because oftentimes we see sort of in Washington people wanting to sort of take control of an issue. And we have seen Democrats and Republicans talking about voting rights, and we've seen that back and forth. We've seen President Trump talking about President Biden. But really what people don't really get is this is something that's going to be happening in localities and states across the country. So if there want, if people want there to be a change, they want to fight back against some of these issues, that's got to happen at the local and state level. You know, Ed mentioned Florida. Florida, the governor there just has been criticized for this bill, which he supports, and he's been outspoken about it. There are officials that are getting influential and gaining popularity because of some of this. So it's going to be an issue for the next couple of years and probably beyond that.
Well, speaking of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, this week, Democratic Representative Charlie Crist announced his bid against the incumbent governor, and he's the first major challenger to DeSantis. Ed, tell us about Congressman Crist. Who is he?
Well, he's the former governor of the state, and he tried to run against Marco Rubio for the Senate back in the day and failed. And he was a Republican governor, turned independent, turned now Democrat, trying to run for his old seat. We'll see if he's the only one that tries to do this. There are others, including two other members of Congress, Val Demings from the Orlando area, Stephanie Murphy from the east coast of Florida, who have said they are mulling potential gubernatorial bids. This is part of a bigger trend across the country. Members of the House Democratic Caucus looking for promotions, and that could potentially jeopardize the House Democratic majority, which is already pretty slim, going into next year. A combination of people looking for higher office and redistricting could make it harder for Democrats to hold on to the House. And, you know, history suggests that in the second year of a presidency, the president's party usually loses control of at least one chamber of Congress. So we'll see what happens. But Crist very quickly jumped on the decision by Governor DeSantis on Thursday to allow his bill signing of that voting rights bill to be broadcast only by Fox News. Crist said, if I were doing that, all of the press would have been invited in. For those of us who don't work for Fox, I think we'd probably have to agree with that sentiment.
That's Ed O'Keefe. He's senior White House and political correspondent with CBS News. And Anita Kumar, an associate editor and White House correspondent for Politico. Ed, Anita, thanks so much. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cheery. But Mike Kidd has generously lent us his talents in the driver's seat this week. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll discuss the week's biggest headlines from around the world in just a moment. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
It's the News Roundup. New reporting from the University of Washington makes grim reading for anyone trying to keep track of global COVID numbers. Its Institute for Metrics says there have been twice as many deaths around the world as have been reported. We have a lot to catch up on, plus important developments in Israel, Ethiopia, and news out of France about a debate that's been raging for over 200 years. Our guests this week are Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor at Vox. Also with us, Joyce Karam, Washington correspondent for The National. And David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. David joins us from Beijing. Well, let's start with President Biden's decision to back a temporary waiver on patents tied to COVID-19 vaccines. The move has been welcomed by countries such as South Africa and India. Germany is not on board, and the news has rattled the pharmaceutical industry. Now, in theory, it paves the way for any pharmaceutical manufacturer in the country to make a copycat vaccine without fear of being sued for intellectual property infringement. Jennifer, what caused the administration to come off the fence now?
Well, the short answer is India, right? The huge spike of cases and deaths and just the drastic humanitarian catastrophe that the world is witnessing happening in India has very much put pressure on the Biden administration to take a lot of actions, including sending, you know, aid to India, sending oxygen, sending vaccines, things like that. And so this is one of the kind of general ideas that were kind of floating out there for a while that the administration was considering in terms of how to kind of address more of a global vaccine, you know, strategy rather than just focusing on the domestic situation here in the U.S. And so this is one of those issues that was out there. They initially had kind of opposed it and were kind of resistant to it. But it seems like the India situation has put a lot of pressure and kind of made them change their minds. And so they, you know, like you said, they announced they're going to be working with the World Trade Organization to negotiate a deal to suspend the intellectual property rights. I think it's important to note they haven't actually officially done that. They're just saying that they're going to work with the WTO to work on a deal to eventually do that. But even, you know, taking that step, it was a bit of a surprise. Like I said, they had initially resisted it. This has been out there for a while. India and South Africa, as far back as November, had put in a proposal, you know, asking for this. And, you know, it seems like finally the U.S. is on board. But like you said, Germany is already pushing back strongly. And, you know, there are real concerns about investment and whether this could, you know, freeze innovation going forward. And there are also concerns that this may not actually address some of the real problems that are actually going on in terms of vaccine distribution and production.
Well, and David, how sure should we be that this will lead to the manufacture of more vaccines?
Well, it will in time, but will it during this pandemic? And I think one of the really striking things is that you had very prominent scientists in Africa saying that this is a welcome step. It set a good precedent, talking about where you might be able to start manufacturing these vaccines eventually in Africa. The most advanced medical system and pharmaceutical industry is in South Africa. But some of them also saying it may not be before this pandemic is over, because it's probably not going to be this year or next year that there is any spare capacity for this very new technology, messenger RNA vaccines. There aren't the scientists, there aren't the production facilities. And so I think it's not just, as Jen said, that America was trying to respond to the terrible crisis in India, which is a kind of an emergency. I think this is also about politics. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about India, it's about China. But at the moment, the only source for most poor countries of vaccines is China, which is using an older technology similar to the kind of flu shots you get at the pharmacy. And it's China that is making a lot of headway politically by saying the Americans and the Europeans, the rich world, are too selfish to send you these vaccines. So I think there is a fear in Europe that America is basically playing politics with patents and kind of precedents that actually will damage the pharmaceutical industry. And they also accuse America of hypocrisy, because the European Union is one of the large places where vaccines are made, along with America, and has exported 200 million doses to 87 countries, whereas America, of course, has kept all its doses basically for itself up till date. So I think there's a lot of resentment in Europe. What they think of is America basically trying to grandstand to score a point against China.
Now, Joyce, as David says there, this will strike some as an opportunity for the U.S. to reassert itself on the world stage. If we assume that's part of the administration's thinking, how much is trust building driving U.S. policy on vaccines?
I mean, obviously, Jen, you would need consensus within the WTO to go ahead with removing patents, but the moral case here is very strong. I mean, you have countries like India, where the level of vaccinations is at 2%, whereas in the U.S. it's 31%. I mean, this is a pandemic. Of course, there is the intellectual property argument that's being made by, you know, Germany and the pharmaceutical firms in the U.S. But this is, again, a pandemic. We need, as you know, as the world, we need the production to be at 11 billion vaccines right now, but it's at 3 billion. We know we can't impose safety. We can't be safe until everyone is safe. And the case of India proves that removing, you know, the patent, removing the waivers could increase the vaccination supply. I mean, when you talk about India being suffering from shortages in vaccine, well, it is the pharmacy for the developing world. I mean, you're heading to a bigger crisis in vaccination disparity that I think prompted this decision by the administration. Now, of course, there will be manufacturing challenges. There will be hurdles along the way. But this is, you know, the moral case behind this is extremely strong and necessary if we want to reach a global herd immunity.
And Jen, I just wonder how this all fits into what we're seeing in the U.S. right now around vaccination, where we're at a point when supply is outstripping demand.
Right. And that's exactly kind of part of the timing here is the Biden administration has been pretty clear that they wanted to focus on the domestic situation first, understandably, right? They, you know, were elected to take care of the United States first. And so, you know, they very much wanted to make sure that the U.S. had hit a specific kind of level of vaccination. And they wanted to make sure that they had enough, you know, left over to make sure that all of, you know, American citizens could get vaccinated. But they're also sitting on, you know, these AstraZeneca vaccines that they just have and, you know, that have not been approved for use in the U.S. And so there's a lot of call for them to put those out into the world and send them to various countries. But I think it's very much tied to, you know, Biden has said, you know, on the campaign trail, et cetera, he wanted the U.S. to be back and a leader in the world. And I think there is some criticism coming for the fact that he did choose to focus, you know, rightly or wrongly on the United States first. And there have been some criticisms that he's following a bit of an America first kind of strategy a la Trump. And so, you know, I think the Biden administration is very sensitive to the political domestic conversation and is trying to kind of walk a little bit of a tightrope here.
Well, let's turn to India, where the pandemic remains out of control. On Thursday, the country reported just under 4,000 deaths and more than 412,000 new infections over a 24-hour period. And those figures are from Johns Hopkins University. Each of these two totals are the highest India has seen in a single day since the pandemic began. And today's numbers are just as bad. Now, earlier this week, we spoke to Clarissa Ward. She's CNN's chief international correspondent in Delhi, and she told us what conditions were like at local hospitals.
There wasn't enough oxygen. There weren't enough doctors. There weren't enough beds. There weren't enough drugs. And because we were wearing the proper protective gear and the proper PPE, which most others do not have the luxury of wearing here, people just kept coming up to us. They thought we were doctors. It was just harrowing and heartbreaking.
Joyce, India shares a porous border with Nepal, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and China. Are there concerns that they too might be impacted by this surge?
Yes, of course. I mean, it's a devastating situation, and the numbers we're seeing are those that are being detected and being reported. So the actual numbers actually coming from India in reality could be much higher. The problem we're seeing now is vaccination is not enough to resolve the crisis in India. They need to go back to a very strict lockdown. They need to contain the virus. Then we can start talking about vaccinations. But the footage that's coming from India is just horrifying. You know, families mourning the dead. Crematoriums are being filled up, so they're moving to parking lots. It's just devastating. I mean, just yesterday they hit a global record of new cases of more than 400,000 cases a day. So this is, if we look at it, I mean, it's close to being a global humanitarian crisis. And as much as you try to contain it within India, we saw just yesterday, Jen, that India's delegation to the G7 in London meeting, they've had cases there too. So this is a very dire situation. We're just seeing, you know, an increase in international aid to India, sending off, you know, medical supplies, oxygen, but it took some time, and we're already in a very bad place, you know, for India and the world.
Don't come home. That was the message from Australia's government earlier this week. It announced that citizens returning to Australia after recently spending time in India could face 5 years in jail and a hefty fine. It sparked a storm of protests and accusations of double standards. Dr. V.M. Sharma, an Australian-Indian general practitioner based in Melbourne, had this to say on the BBC.
We know for a fact that there were more positive cases coming back into quarantine from the USA during January than we are currently seeing come back from India to Australia now. This did not happen to a completely different set of people who look very different to us. The fact that we are being threatened with imprisonment of 5 years, that's ridiculous.
Now, Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison has since backed away from earlier threats to send people to prison, but he doubled down on the reason why the penalties needed to be severe.
I, you know, respectfully disagree with the critics on this one, but the buck stops here when it comes to these decisions, and I'm going to take decisions that I believe are going to protect Australia from a third wave and help me to be able to reach out and bring more Australians safely home from places where they're in difficult situations.
David, to go back to what we heard from the doctor in Melbourne, why does there appear to be one rule for people coming back from India and another for people coming back from a country like the United States?
The United States, or in fact the UK. So clearly you've had a number of countries have really serious second waves. The UK is an interesting example as well because it had the UK mutation. This was before, obviously, India had its terrible third wave and its mutations. And the Australian government never banned Australian citizens from coming back from the US or the UK. And I think it's that ban on Australian citizens that has been so shocking, because the truth is that although travel bans, you know, scientists are a bit divided about how well they work, lots and lots of countries have basically eliminated flights, direct flights at least, from places with very bad outbreaks like India. So there's a very long list of countries in Europe and the US which have basically stopped direct flights from India. The really strange thing about the Australian ban was that even being an Australian citizen didn't get you back from India. Now, America, for example, has never done that. Even at the worst of the kind of travel bans in the Trump era, American citizens could always go back to America. So I think it's that sign that they're kind of breaking the social contract with their own people, and that suspicion that maybe it's because the clip you played from the Indian-Australian doctor, because maybe there's a suspicion that some of the conservative supporters of this populist conservative government in Australia look at pictures of Indian Australians and think, well, maybe those aren't our people.
Mm-hmm. Now, Joyce, Scott Morrison has traditionally taken a hard line on who the country should allow in. But as David points out, we're talking about Australian citizens here. So don't they have the right to return? Is this even legal to prevent them from coming back into the country?
Very good question, Jen. And it's severe, the extent he went with this ban. I mean, that he had to actually announce today that he's walking back and reversing it, and the Australians would be able to come back next week. The problem is, you know, that the penalties that he was enforcing also with the ban, like jail terms, financial fines, you have 13 Australian children stuck in India. You have cricket team players. You have 9,000 Australian citizens and permanent residents who are in India. So this feels just another level from other travel restrictions that are imposed, you know, by the US, by the UAE, by Canada, by other countries. And I think it created a public backlash that he had to announce he's walking it back, and the travel will resume for Australian citizens next week.
Well, let's touch on one more piece of COVID news. On Wednesday, Canada became the first country in the world to authorize use of the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine for children between 12 and 15. Dr. Supriya Sharma is chief medical advisor with Health Canada.
Since the beginning of the pandemic, approximately 20% of cases of COVID-19 in Canada have been reported in people under the age of 19. While younger people are less likely to experience serious cases of COVID-19, having access to a safe and effective vaccine will help control the disease's spread to their families and friends. It'll also support the return to a more normal life for our children who have had such a hard time over the past year.
Now, the United States is expected to follow shortly, and stay tuned because we'll be talking more about this on the show next week. But Jen, if we assume we're not too far behind Canada on vaccinating those over the age of 12, how does this change our ability to put COVID in the rearview mirror?
Well, you know, it's definitely seen as a big step forward, especially when it comes to issues around schooling. You know, we've had this past, you know, year plus of the pandemic, the issue of children going to school, the issue of teachers feeling safe being in the classroom with children. Vaccination is certainly seen, you know, of children in that age group is seen as a next big step toward getting to that herd immunity. Now, you know, remember, children are much less susceptible to getting the virus and also to experiencing, you know, severe symptoms, which is why we have, you know, focused on starting with the elderly and other highly sensitive populations and then moving to just general adult population. So there was a reason why we didn't start with kids. But I think, you know, we are seeing, including with new variants, we're seeing younger and younger people starting to get it. And so there is a growing concern that that could be, you know, part of future waves. And so spreading that vaccination schedule to include younger and younger populations is definitely seen as a big step forward. But, you know, it's going to take a while. And it also means that, you know, are we prioritizing children who are at less risk over sending those vaccines abroad to countries where there are people who are still at much higher risk than children? So it's still making a judgment call, both from a public health standpoint and from a moral standpoint, about whether this is really the next step that we should be making or whether we should continue to prioritize the most vulnerable around the world.
Well, let's head now to Ethiopia, where the interim head of the country's Tigray region government was replaced this week amid the ongoing violence in the region. Thousands of people have died, and the U.S. has called what's happening in Tigray ethnic cleansing. Jen, just what's going on in Tigray? What is this conflict about?
Right. So there's a it's been going on for several months now. Essentially, it's really complicated. My colleague Jen Kirby at Vox has a phenomenal explainer on it that gets into a lot of the history and the details. But essentially, there was a split between the regional government in Tigray, the group that ran it used to be in charge of Ethiopia. The new, you know, president Abiy Ahmed has basically, from a different kind of political standpoint, is trying to kind of make a more nationalized, less ethnically kind of run party. And so there's been this tension kind of going on for a while now. So it kind of trending in the background. And that actually erupted into violence when the TPLF, according to the government, the TPLF, that's the Tigray's People's Liberation Front, that's the political party that represents Tigray. The federal government said that they attacked this federal military facility. And the government then launched this kind of law enforcement operation, as they called it, in response, kind of invaded the region, took over the capital. And there's essentially been ongoing civil war ever since. That's the kind of background that's happening. Now, when the Ethiopian federal government took over the capital of Tigray, they put in this person that was just fired, essentially. They had, you know, he was the head of this interim administration that was supposed to essentially kind of try to set up an interim government while the fighting continued. They are now saying that after his, quote, performance review was done, that he has been replaced now. So they weren't apparently particularly happy with his performance there. So that's kind of the latest. But the broader context is that this violence is still going on. It's still a bloody civil war. Eritrean forces from next door have now gotten involved. There are other ethnic groups that have been brought in by their federal government to participate. We're now having reports of rape and, you know, mass violence and, you know, ethnic cleansing and just really horrific stuff.
Well, President Biden sent Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware to the region in March to look at how to address the conflict.
It is clear the conflict is continuing in Tigray. It is not over and not resolved. There still needs to be accountability for human rights violations, a ceasefire, the removal of foreign troops, Eritrean troops in particular, from Tigray, and a path towards a resolution of this conflict.
That was Democrat Chris Coons speaking to Al Jazeera in Ethiopia earlier this year. Now, David, this week, Ahmed's Council of Ministers classified the Tigray People's Liberation Front as a terrorist group. The TPLF, as Jen laid out, has ruled the region for decades before Abiy Ahmed took office. How likely do you think a ceasefire is at this point?
The problem is this is really a civil war with a very nasty ethnic edge. I mean, the history is complex, but essentially, after a military dictatorship was overthrown in the 80s, you had about a quarter of a century where this very awkward ethnic coalition of different clans and ethnic groups had this kind of coalition government. And one of the leading parties in that was basically from Tigray. When that fell apart because there were massive public protests and basically that government became more and more unpopular, and you had the emergence of the new government under Mr. Abiy in 2018, the Tigrayans, who had been top dogs in the old federal coalition system, basically started more or less trying to break away. They have about a quarter of a million militia soldiers who are under pretty heavily armed. They accuse the federal government of Ethiopia of using troops from next door Eritrea to try and help them, which then wakens memories of a very, very nasty conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea. And, you know, Ethiopia is a big country. and it is one of the oldest democracies in Africa, but very troubled, and the potential for a civil war along ethnic lines is really, really high.
Well, in his 15 years as Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu has set two landmarks. He's both its longest-serving leader and its first to face criminal prosecution while in office. Israel's March election led to inconclusive results, and Netanyahu was tasked with putting together a new government within 28 days. That deadline passed this week, which begs the question, what happens next? Joyce, what does happen next?
It's definitely a very interesting week in Israel, Jen. We could be seeing a turning point from the Bibi Netanyahu era that we've, you know, that has been governing Israel in the last 12 years. But it's all up to the new coalition that's trying to form with Naftali Bennett as a potential prime minister. I mean, we've seen this play before for at least four times, and successive attempts had failed at forming a coalition government. What's different now is there seemed to be a desire among the other political leaders in Israel to just swallow the Naftali Bennett pill in order to get rid of Netanyahu. If that happens in the next 28 days, we are moving in a new to a new government, and Bibi will be for the first time since 2009 in the opposition. If they fail to form a coalition, then we will be headed to a fifth election in Israel. So it's very interesting to watch Israeli politics right now. A lot of issues at play, you know, security, the social cohesion, the rise of the right that Bennett is capitalizing on to have edge in this new coalition if it forms.
Jen, tell us more about the opposition party, which is led by Yair Lapid, who now has these 28 days to put a coalition together.
Sure. So he leads the Yesh Atid party. It means there is a future. It's a very centrist party. Yair Lapid is very much a centrist. And when we're saying centrist, I mean basically kind of right down the middle, very much, kind of leaning toward, in things like the, policy toward the Palestinians, very much kind of the general consensus view among Israelis of what should be done, kind of supports a two-state solution, kind of the general policy we've seen versus, Netanyahu or even Naftali Bennett, much farther to the right, much harder line stance for the Palestinians. Naftali Bennett opposes any kind of Palestinian state. You know, he refers to parts of the Palestinian occupied territories as, under religious language, calling it Judea and Samaria. He won't even say, Gaza, West Bank, things like that. He is very, very much a religious Zionist, but you have him potentially coming into a coalition with Yair Lapid, Mr. Right Down the Middle centrist. And that's partly why people are worried that even if they do manage to scramble together a coalition, that it would be really shaky. And it wouldn't just be the two of them either, right? They also would have to bring together a whole bunch of other parties, including the Islamist party potentially, which further complicates matters. How do you have an Islamist party and, Naftali Bennett all in a coalition together? So again, it really raises the question that even if they do manage to work out their own issues together, cobbling together this broader coalition could be really unstable. And again, if it falls, then like Joyce said, you're going to end up right back in elections. And it just feels like Israel is so much stuck in this cycle. But I do think there is an inkling of, I don't know if I would call it hope, but change in the works, that people are starting to think, wow, what could actually look like without Netanyahu at the helm for the first time in so many years. And so, we'll definitely see. I think there is a push to really try to have this kind of change. Whether that change ends up being stable is a big question.
But Bibi has loomed so large for so long. Why would anyone assume he's ready to take a backseat?
Well, nobody thinks he's ready to take a backseat. I think that's the point. I think people are ready for him to take a backseat is kind of the difference and the distinction there. I don't think Bibi ever wants to leave power, especially not right now. Remember, he's facing trial for corruption. And so one of the main reasons why he wants to stay in power is that, so he can't you know, is trying to kind of basically protect himself from being prosecuted and from going to jail potentially. I think a lot of people in the opposition obviously would like Bibi to go, but I think there's also just kind of a general sense that maybe Bibi's star is falling because of, you know, the issues, not just with obviously his prosecution and the corruption, but just the kind of, you know, ongoing political kind of stalemate. He's very much seen as the one blocking everything from changing. So people are ready for him to go. He's not ready.
Now for a headline from the east of England. Soccer fans are paying tribute to the singer-songwriter Ed Sheeran for putting his hand in his pocket to become the new shirt sponsor for his local club. Fans of Ipswich Football Club are known as Tractor Boys, and Ed is one of them. The club is owned by a U.S. investment fund, but there's no word yet if Sheeran wants to own anything more than a space on the team's jersey. Let's move now to Iran. Its former minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has apologized for comments he made in a leaked recording that appeared to be critical of the country's supreme leader. David, what were these comments?
Well, this recording, I think the word murky was invented for the leak of this recording. It's ostensibly a seven-hour interview for an oral history project in the presidential office, but the timing is extraordinarily suspicious because we not only have obviously, the foreign minister, Mr. Zarif, is the chief negotiator on the nuclear accord, which America is trying to revive right now with talks in Vienna. There are hardliners in Iran who don't want that Iran nuclear deal revived. There's also going to be a presidential election in late June, and the current president, Rouhani, has to step down. It's two terms. And so Zarif was actually potentially a presidential candidate. So there are many, many hardliners who would like to see Zarif brought down, and this recording is exceptionally embarrassing. As you say, there's a whole bunch of stuff in there criticizing not just the military but the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei, also criticizing some very revered figures like the murdered or the assassinated head of the Revolutionary Guard Qasem Soleimani. Who was the leader of the Al-Quds force, who was killed, if you remember, by the Trump administration in a drone strike in Iraq. He's been quite critical of him and essentially said that as the foreign minister, the Revolutionary Guard and the Al-Quds force and Soleimani were doing stuff in terms of sending troops to Syria, in terms of starting proxy fights that he did not know about. And he talks in this recording about how at one point he discovered that President Assad of Syria was in Iran, though he was the foreign minister, by watching the TV and seeing Assad on TV in Iran. And so he then went to try and to tender his resignation because this was such an obvious sign that the kind of the deep state in Iran is so much more powerful than the government and the foreign minister. His foreign ministry resignation was turned down. But this is really tearing open at an extremely sensitive time the fact that the government that you can see with the ministers and the president is actually far weaker than the military and the Revolutionary Guard.
And how did Iran's leader respond to this leak?
Well, we have seen Zarif sort of saying that he has a very special relationship with Ayatollah Khamenei, saying that he apologizes for this leak. But essentially, you know, this is also intensely embarrassing because Zarif was getting his information in some cases from the Americans. And he talks about John Kerry, when John Kerry was Secretary of State, telling him about Israeli attacks on Iranian proxies in Syria. John Kerry has tweeted that this is unequivocally false. So this is basically making trouble for almost everyone involved in the Iranian conflict and the Iran nuclear deal, which the Americans otherwise are saying could be on the brink of being revived.
Well, also this week, Jared Kushner, former senior advisor to former President Trump, is founding an organization to foster peace between Israel and neighboring Arab countries. This organization is called the Abraham Accords, based on the foreign policy initiative signed by President Trump. Joyce, what more can you tell us?
I mean, yes, this is a new institution that think tank that Jared Kushner is starting. On its board will be the UAE ambassador to Washington, Yusuf Al-Utaiba, and the Bahraini ambassador to Washington, Al-Khalifa. So in a sense, this is to commemorate, you know, the effort and the legacy of the Abraham Accords. That's different from past peace agreements between Israel and its neighbors, has seen, you know, economic relations, consular relations, and people-to-people normalization. So the Kushner team sees this as their biggest foreign policy success. And now that he's out of government, he's hoping to build on it to get other Arab countries to normalize with Israel. But the think tank world is very crowded in D.C., and it remains to be seen if this would have a big impact going forward in shaping the political relations between Israel and its neighbors.
Well, and David, how would you assess his role in trying to broker peace in the Middle East? He's no longer serving in government in any capacity.
It's an extraordinary thing that when he first started as a Middle East envoy, there was, you know, overwhelming opposition from all sides saying that he was essentially, his game was to come in and side with everything that Bibi Netanyahu and the Israeli government wanted and to basically sell out the Palestinians. It's interesting that although he is clearly pro-Israeli and not pro-Palestinian, his insight that actually lots of Sunni Arab countries were also ready to betray and abandon the Palestinians and therefore might be willing to cut a deal in public with the Israelis if America threw in enough sweeteners, turned out to be an accurate reading of at least the countries that did sign those Abraham Accords. And of course, one of the interesting things is that the Biden administration has praised the Abraham Accords and said that they are a positive step, that they are not going to unwind. So it is as if Jared Kushner, for all of his kind of obvious lack of balance and pro-Israeli slant, he did correctly identify a kind of gap in the market where Sunni Arab countries were willing to throw the Palestinians under the bus in return for some pretty hefty concessions that America made on some long-running disputes in places like Morocco, which made diplomats at the time suck their teeth. But the Biden administration isn't about to undo what he did.
Jen, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting, I think everything that David said is absolutely spot on. But I think it's also interesting that there's a particular figure who's also involved in founding this institute with Jared Kushner, and that's Chaim Saban. And he is, you know, an Israeli-American businessman. He is famous for being the, I believe, the executive producer, if I have the title correct, of the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers series. I also, full disclosure, I used to work at a center at the Brookings Institution think tank that was partially funded by Chaim Saban back when I was there. But he is a Democratic donor. He's a big donor. He's a big supporter of Israel. But he is also very much affiliated often with the Democrats. And so the fact that he has kind of thrown his name in and his money, more importantly, in the ring with this is certainly an interesting kind of shift to see. He's very much often, you know, worked a lot with the likes of John Kerry when he was doing, Middle East negotiations. And just as David said, you know, John Kerry himself is on the record having said something to the effect of, you know, these sorts of normalization deals will never, ever happen until, you know, you have a deal with the Palestinians, and saying that just it's not going to happen. Give it up. Stop saying this. It's never going to happen. It's not in the cards. And then here comes Jared Kushner and saying, oh, look, I did it. So I think it is interesting to see that maybe some of the donors and some of the people who have been more supportive of traditionally Democrats are starting to see that maybe there was, you know, a correct policy, intuition, at least in some respect. Now, what this actually means for the future of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, remains to be seen, particularly with respect to what this means for the Palestinians themselves.
Well, a train in Mexico crashed after an overpass collapse in Mexico City this week. The crash killed about 24 people and at least an additional 70 were hospitalized in the aftermath. Jen, quickly tell us what we know about this crash.
So, yes, the crash occurred kind of late in the evening. It was on one of the newest stretches of the track in the subway system called the Golden Line. It's also called Line 12. This is a new part that was inaugurated in 2012. Nearly a quarter of a million passengers ride the line every day. Basically, there was this overpass that collapsed and the train plunged some 50 feet. It was really horrific. There's awful video and it was just an awful kind of disaster scene. But this is something that has been a problem for years. Local residents had been complaining about the integrity of this specific overpass for a long time, including literal cracks in the concrete. If you remember, there was a devastating earthquake that hit the city back in September 2017. And ever since, you know, local residents and workers who were hired to operate and maintain the system had been complaining to the authorities over the years saying, you need to fix these. And they were all seemingly ignored. And so it has now set off not just this tragedy, but it's set off this political firestorm with even the president being accused of, you know, these fiscal austerity measures that have essentially starved the capital of the money it needs to work on the subway system. So it's become a much larger political kind of fight that's going on beyond just the kind of awful tragedy of the accident itself.
Well, let's turn to Colombia now, where clashes with police have turned violent. By some accounts, at least 37 people have died in protests throughout the country, and at least 87 are missing. David, first, why are we seeing widespread protests in Colombia?
Well, the initial spark was a tax bill. The right-wing government of Colombia has been trying to shore up the public finances, which are in trouble for a bunch of reasons, but particularly the COVID pandemic has hit Colombia, like so many middle-income countries, really, really hard, and their public finances are bleeding money. And so the finance minister, Alberto Carrasquilla, he suggested that they should have an elimination of many tax breaks to try and make more people pay income tax. His argument was that the rich were going to pay the most, and that this was going to give welfare payments to the poorest Colombians. But the problem is that Colombia, so many people have lost their jobs, so many business owners have lost their businesses because of the COVID pandemic, that the idea of new taxes, even if the government was trying to say that they were going to be sort of redistributing income to the poorest, they wouldn't tolerate them. Unfortunately, as the protests took hold, the president, Iván Duque, responded with real brutality, sent in the police and then eventually the army. There's TV footage of an armored vehicle in Bogota, the capital, firing live ammunition at people. So at least 24 people are dead. And the problem is this is now just exploding into a much larger sense of frustration with the government of Iván Duque, which has been in power almost 3 years. And so you're seeing protesters saying that they want to have the end of a bill that would have privatized part of the health system. They want a guaranteed minimum income. They want an end to the government eradicating coca crops. And this is turning into an argument about the fact that the government had promised to bring more security to rural areas, which still see devastating violence. Even though the main rebel group that listeners will remember, the FARC, has had a peace accord, there are other groups, which are guerrilla groups, very nasty criminal groups. The level of cocaine exporting out of Colombia has risen. So there's a sense that the country is really on the brink, and which will worry the Americans greatly. You're seeing a left-wing populist, Gustavo Petro, running on a program that sounds a lot like the late Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And Colombia to date has not elected a kind of Chavez-style left-wing populist. So I think if you're sitting in Washington, you're looking at this, and it's not just a tax protest, it's a real potential domino that could fall.
Joyce, as you're watching Colombia and thinking ahead to its election next year, how do you think this unrest might affect that election?
I mean, this very much emphasizes the economic issues, the rising poverty numbers in Bogota itself and in Colombia. The protests themselves are not new. I mean, we've seen similar kind of protests and movement before the pandemic in 2019. What changed now is the poverty just in Bogota has risen by 42.5%, Jen. And in the whole country during the pandemic, 2.8 million are poorer today than they were. So as David said, real economic disparities and inequalities are at the core of this movement now. They have canceled the tax reform plan that unleashed these new protests, but the country is dealing with a deep economic crisis that will sure play out in the election.
Well, finally, let's turn to France. President Macron is big on remembrance, and he's called for conversations on colonialism and slavery. But this week, Macron went all in on Napoleon. He paid tribute to Napoleon Bonaparte as the country marked the bicentenary of the emperor's death. But legacy divides opinion. Unlike previous French presidents, Macron is a fan.
De l'Empire, We've denounced the worst of the empire and embellished the best of the emperor. On this bicentennial commemoration, let us remember to not give in to the temptation to look at history anachronistically, that is, to judge the past with the values of the present.
Jin, why would Macron choose this moment to step into a culture war over one of the country's most famous historical figures?
That's a really good question. I think a lot of people are asking that, but I think, you know, a lot of this is domestic politics. Very much Macron is trying to defend against a bit of a right flank. He has been trying to appeal to more of the kind of right-leaning voters worried about, you know, a bit of a challenge from Marine Le Pen in particular on the far right. This is also coming in the context of the big fight with, within France over Islam and the role of Islam in France. And so this is kind of part of a broader conversation that's also happening. But I think, you know, it's a very sensitive topic, obviously. And it's something that has really, I think, ignited a conversation in France, unlike, I think, even probably Macron was expecting. Interestingly enough, you know, if he was trying to kind of appeal to the right, Marine Le Pen herself actually criticized him for not celebrating the legacy kind of even stronger of Napoleon. So it seems that if that was his electoral play that he was doing, that it may have failed. But, you know, there's a lot of criticism in particular because of Napoleon's, support for slavery. He, you know, if you remember in 1802, he restored slavery by decree in the French Caribbean, though it hadn't been abolished. And so, you know, the legacy of slavery is part of Napoleon's legacy. And it's really important that France reckons with that. And it's seen as Macron not really doing that.
Well, and France is just one country dealing with its history with slavery. Jennifer Williams is senior foreign editor at Vox. Up late from the Chinese capital, David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist, and Joyce Karam, Washington correspondent for The National. Thanks to you all. 1A's senior producer is Jacqueline Hill. Paige Osborne is our managing producer. Our sound engineer is Jake Cherry, and Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and let's talk again soon. This is 1A.